Imagine you're reviewing a corporate resume, right? The candidate has spent years as a regional manager overseeing these huge overseas economic portfolios.
Right, handling high-level procurement, managing complex commercial relationships.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they direct international fundraising. They sound exactly like a Fortune 500 CFO, right?
Oh, complete.
But what if their actual title was Emir of the Aleppo Forces for a designated terrorist group? Today, we're taking a deep dive into the executives who actually fund terror.
The ultimate behind-the-scenes operators.
Yeah, exactly. Because we get so fixated on, the tip of the spear, the
Wow.
fighters, the ideological propaganda.
Right, the frontline combat. We completely ignore the logistical supply chain that's holding that spear up.
Which is crazy.
I mean, spreadsheets, wire transfers, and procurement invoices are honestly just as lethal as firearms if you know how to use them.
And that is our mission for this deep dive. Today, we're basing our conversation on a really fascinating report. It's titled Inside the Financial Networks of Terror: How the U.S. and Turkey Targeted Syrian Group Facilitators.
That's a great read.
It really is. And the goal here is for you, the listener, to understand how these illicit networks operate in plain sight. I mean, they're using the exact same global banking and commerce systems that you use every single day.
Yeah, hiding right in the open.
Right. And we're going to explore how authorities actually try to stop them. So, okay, let's unpack this, because the core premise here is that armed groups, they simply cannot function on violence alone.
Oh, definitely
They
not.
have to make payroll, right? They have to pay for transport, safe houses, communications, medical treatment, and obviously munitions.
What's fascinating here is that the people organizing these financial flows, they are almost completely invisible compared to the field commanders.
Huh, really?
Yeah, because a financial facilitator's primary job is to provide access to bank accounts, to money transfer businesses, wealthy donors, and equipment suppliers.
Oh, wow.
And since they operate across, multiple global jurisdictions, their daily activity is incredibly difficult to distinguish from just legitimate international commerce.
Because it just looks like normal business.
Exactly. Identifying a terrorist organization isn't just about pointing at a known militant group at the end of a payment chain. It's about recognizing the intermediaries in the middle who make that organization financially functional.
Right. So to understand how these networks actually hide, we need to look at who is running them, right? The report centers on a coordinated sanctions action taken on May 2, 2023, by the U.S. and Turkey.
Yeah, a major joint operation.
And they targeted two very different types of alleged facilitators. Let's start with the first profile, Omar El-Sheikh. I mentioned that corporate resume earlier, and according to the U.S. Treasury, this guy was essentially the executive.
He really was. The Treasury detailed that El-Sheikh held leadership positions within Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, often abbreviated as HTS and its predecessor, the al-Nusra Front, for many years.
Wow, so a long history there.
Oh, yeah. He was listed as a member of the group's Shura Council, an emir connected to their Aleppo forces, and supervisor of their overseas economic portfolio.
Overseeing an overseas economic portfolio for an armed group, I mean, that means he isn't just like writing checks.
Right.
He's directing international supporters on how to move resources to the operational units on the ground. Basically, he's a CFO commanding a private army.
Yeah, but tracking a CFO of that nature introduces a massive operational headache for the global banking system, mainly through something called alias management.
Okay, wait, I want to stop you there because that just sounds like a simple data entry problem.
You'd think so, yeah.
Right, like you have his name, you put in a database. If he tries to open an account, the computer just says no. Why is that such a headache?
Well, let's look at the mechanics of how banking software actually screens people. A lot of legacy systems, they rely on exact character matching.
Okay.
But Al-Sheikh was also known by the alias Abu Ahmed Zakur. In this context, basic screening controls fail constantly due to transliteration and naming conventions.
Because of different alphabets.
Exactly. Arabic doesn't use the Latin alphabet, so when a name is translated into English characters, you get wide variations. I mean, think about how many ways you can spell Muhammad in English.
Oh, right. Dozens of ways.
Right. Furthermore, you have kunyas.
Kunyas. What is that?
They're Arabic honorifics or nicknames. So Abu means father of.
Okay.
So Abu Ahmed means father of Ahmed. It's an incredibly common, respectful way to address someone.
Interesting.
So imagine you are trying to find a specific criminal named John Smith in a global banking database, but all you know is he goes by the nickname Smitty.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Right, and sometimes it's spelled with one T, and sometimes it's an I instead of a Y. If a bank's software requires an exact match for John Smith, a wire transfer to Smitty just sails right through without a single red flag.
Wow, so a guy with a private army gets his money because a compliance computer was, like, looking for a Y instead of an I.
Pretty much.
That is genuinely terrifying.
Which is why modern screening has to be heavily contextual, you know? Tying names to dates of birth, specific regional locations, known associates.
Right, okay, so that's the executive profile.
Mm-hmm.
But the report also highlights a totally different type of facilitator, the purchaser.
Yeah, a completely different operational role.
Right, this is the second individual sanctioned in that May 2023 action, an Istanbul-based man named Kubilay Sari.
Sari was accused of facilitating funds for a completely different armed group, Khatibat al-Tahid wal-Jihad. They're a predominantly Uzbek group operating in Syria.
And the Treasury stated that from early 2018, Sari allegedly receives funds in Turkey from various donors specifically to buy equipment.
Mm.
And the list is just wild.
It really is.
Firearms, mortars, motorcycles, night vision technology. But wait, let me push back on this for a second.
Go ahead.
If I go to my local bank right now and try to wire $50,000 with a memo line that says mortars and night vision goggles.
Yeah, that wouldn't go well.
Right. The system is going to lock me out immediately, and I'll probably have law enforcement at my door by dinner.
Oh, definitely.
So how does a bank not immediately flag that? I mean, how does a guy buying heavy munitions look anything like normal community fundraising?
Because the bank never actually sees a line item for mortars. You have to think about the fragmentation of the procurement cycle.
Okay, what does that mean?
The money coming in from donors, it usually arrives in relatively small amounts. To the bank's automated systems, 50 incoming transfers of $200, they look exactly like a local charity drive.
Or like a wedding fund, maybe.
Exactly. Or family support remittances. The money just sits in a standard personal account. Then it gets moved again to a merchant. And if that merchant sells dual-use products, meaning things that have legitimate commercial uses but can also be adapted for conflict, like heavy-duty commercial drones, certain industrial chemicals, ruggedized vehicles, the purchase looks perfectly legal?
Wow. So if a guy whose stated occupation on his bank account is, like, a baker, and he suddenly starts receiving dozens of small wire transfers.
Right.
And then he wires a huge lump sum to a wholesale electronics supplier. Unless the bank stops and asks why the baker is buying 10 high-end night vision cameras, it just looks like normal commerce.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, modern terrorist financing isn't a guy carrying a metal briefcase full of cash across a border anymore.
Right. It's not the movies?
No, it is a highly blended methodology. They use digital platforms and social media to raise the funds. Then they use standard regulated bank accounts to hold those funds temporarily.
Oh, I see.
They use digital wallets for rapid movement. And then crucially, they might use informal, weekly regulated value transfer systems like Hawala networks to actually settle the obligations in the conflict zone.
Completely outside conventional banking.
Exactly.
Okay, I hear the term Hawala all the time in these contexts, but what actually is it? Like, how does a Hawala network function?
So Hawala is this ancient trust-based system of transferring value without actually moving physical money.
Okay.
Let's say a donor in London wants to send $10,000 to a militant in Aleppo.
Right.
The donor gives $10,000 in cash to a Hawala broker in London. That broker calls another Hawala broker in Aleppo and just says, hey, give the militant the equivalent of $10,000 in local currency.
Amen.
The Aleppo broker pays the militant out of his own pocket.
Wait, really? So the physical cash never crossed the border?
Never. Not a single bill.
But now the London broker owes the Aleppo broker $10,000. I mean, how do they settle that debt if they aren't using banks?
Usually through trade or future transactions. So maybe the Aleppo broker needs to buy imported electronics a month later.
Oh, I see.
Right. The London broker pays the European supplier for those electronics, and the debt is settled. It's a completely decentralized ledger system held entirely in the heads and notebooks of these trusted brokers.
That is wild.
And it leaves almost zero paper trail in the formal financial system.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Mm-hmm. Because these facilitators spread the money across all these different systems.
Mm.
You know, digital apps, formal banks, Hawala ledgers.
Yeah.
No single institution ever sees the complete chain. Like the digital platform just sees a $20 donation, the regulated bank just sees a temporary deposit.
Exactly.
And the wholesale merchant just sees a customer buying motorcycles.
And that is the core dilemma for authorities.
Yeah.
Suspicion only becomes visible when data is connected across parties, across time, and across geography.
Right.
Effective counter-terrorist financing isn't about treating every single transaction near a conflict zone as suspicious. If banks did that, legitimate global aid, food shipments, and civilian commerce would just grind to a halt.
Which would be a disaster.
Yeah, huge disaster. The focus has to be on network risk.
Network risk.
Yeah.
Okay, meaning you have to look for the unseen connections between accounts rather than just isolated bad behavior.
Exactly. You are looking for shared contact details. Mm. So maybe 50 seemingly unrelated accounts all log in using the exact same IP address.
Oh, wow.
Or they list the same phone number. You're also looking for beneficial owners.
Beneficial owners. Let's define that for the audience real quick.
Sure. A beneficial owner is the person who ultimately owns or controls a company, even if their name isn't anywhere on the official paperwork.
Gotcha.
Illicit networks constantly set up shell companies with frontmen, maybe a local cousin or a paid proxy acting as the director. But the beneficial owner, the person actually pulling the strings and taking the profits, is the facilitator.
Right.
So if banks aren't digging deep enough to find the beneficial owner, they are just screening the puppet, not the puppeteer.
So if this money is bouncing between a digital app in Europe, a front company in Istanbul, and a ledger in a hawala broker's head in Syria, I mean, how on earth does one country's law enforcement stop it?
It's incredibly difficult.
They have a massive jurisdictional wall. Which brings us to the May 2023 joint action. How did the U.S. and Turkey actually break that wall down?
Well, it requires immense coordination because neither country could do it alone. The U.S. and Turkish partnership here was operationally massive.
How so?
When the U.S. Treasury designates someone, they block any property under U.S. jurisdiction. But the real power is that it affects almost any transaction cleared in U.S. dollars globally.
Because of secondary sanctions, right?
Yes. If a foreign bank in Europe or Asia processes a U.S. dollar transaction for a designated terrorist facilitator, that foreign bank risks losing its own access to the U.S. financial system.
Oh, well, that is a massive stick.
It really is. It forces global banks to comply with U.S. lists. However, the U.S. dollar mechanism has a blind spot. If the facilitator is operating entirely in local currency, buying local real estate, and keeping their assets in domestic Turkish accounts, the U.S. sanctions might not immediately disrupt their day-to-day life at all.
And that's where Turkey comes in.
Precisely. By implementing simultaneous domestic asset freezes, Turkey targeted the funds, the local accounts, and the business relationships right where these alleged facilitators were living and operating.
Wow, okay. It's a dual strike. The U.S. cuts them off from the global financial system, and Turkey basically locks the doors to their local assets.
Yeah, exactly.
And because they did it on the exact same day, they removed the opportunity for these guys to quickly move their assets across borders before the other jurisdiction acted.
Right, no time to react.
And this actually mirrored a similar joint operation they ran back in January 2023, targeting Islamic State financing, right?
Yes, it did. But, you know, designing a joint strike at the government level is one thing. Putting this into practice falls squarely on the shoulders of financial crime and compliance leaders at the actual banks.
Which begs the question, what are compliance teams actually supposed to do? Like, if the network is specifically designed to look normal, how do they catch it?
It's tough.
The report outlines what it calls a resilient control stack, which is this five-layer system.
Let's break down those five layers. Layer one is continuous sanctions screening. This is the baseline.
Okay.
It means checking customers, beneficial owners, and counterparties against current data continuously. And accounting for all those complex aliases, non-Latin scripts, and cunhas we discussed.
Okay, so if this is like a high-end casino, layer one is the bouncer at the front door checking IDs, making sure known cheaters don't get inside.
A great analogy, yeah.
Yeah.
But cheaters use fake IDs, which brings us to layer two, context.
Context, okay.
Even for low-value transfers, the bank has to analyze the stated occupation of the customer against their expected activity.
Right, so back in the casino, the bouncer let the guy in. But now, you're watching the betting patterns. If a guy who says he's a minimum wage baker starts betting $10,000 a hand at the blackjack table, the context makes zero sense.
Spot on. Layer three is network analytics. This is moving beyond monitoring a single customer and looking for those shared addresses, shared devices, and shared phone numbers that link multiple accounts together.
Oh, so that's the casino's eye in the sky security cameras.
Yeah, the overhead view.
You aren't just watching the baker at the blackjack table. You're zooming out to see that he keeps taking bathroom breaks to talk to four other guys who, you know, all arrives in the same car.
Right. Now, layer four is procurement intelligence. This is the contextual review of what the customer is actually buying.
Yeah.
Specifically looking for dual-use equipment and unexplained links to conflict zones.
So watching what they buy at the bar or the gift shop, like if our baker goes to the casino retail store and buys 50 ruggedized radios, warning bells should be ringing.
Definitely. And finally, layer five is disciplined escalation. When a red flag goes up across these layers, information has to move rapidly between the bank's anti-money laundering team, the fraud department, cyber analysts, and investigators.
They all have to talk to each other.
Yes. They have to freeze transactions and engage law enforcement immediately.
So you have the bouncers on radio standby, ready to move instantly before the money leaves the building. I mean, if you only rely on the guy at the front door, you're going to get robbed blind. You need all five layers.
You really do. But building that five-layer security stack is only half the battle.
Oh, great.
Yeah, because the rules of the game, the literal laws dictating who the bouncer is supposed to keep out of the casino, they constantly change. Which brings us to today, August 2026.
Right. So the source notes detail this massive geopolitical shift that happened over the last year. In 2025, the broad U.S. Syria sanctions program was terminated.
Big shift.
Yeah. Then the U.S. Foreign Terrorist Organization designation for the al-Nusra Front and HTS, the groups connected to our first profile, the executive Omar al-Sheikh, that designation was revoked in July 2025.
And then the UN followed suit.
Right, removing their entity listing entirely in February 2026.
However, Katibat al-Tahid wal-Jihad, the group connected to our second profile, Kubilai Sari, they remain listed under the UN ISIL and al-Qaeda regime.
Okay, wait, let me make sure I understand this. You're saying the geopolitical weather changed so drastically that a group the U.S. and Turkey actively targeted back in 2023 was suddenly taken off the UN's list 3 years later.
Yes, exactly.
What does a compliance officer actually do on a Tuesday morning when they read that in the news? Do these facilitators just, like, get all their frozen money back?
This raises an important question, and it is the ultimate nightmare for a compliance officer. The 2025 and 2026 developments do not magically invalidate the historical 2023 action.
Okay, so what do they mean?
What they prove is that compliance teams cannot rely on archived reports, old news articles, or static internal memos.
Because a single individual might be sanctioned under multiple different legal umbrellas.
Precisely. You have overarching country programs, specific group designations, and individual targeted listings. Just because the broad Syria sanctions program ended, it doesn't automatically mean restrictions are removed for every connected person.
I see.
The source of truth for a bank must be the current applicable list on that specific day, supported by fresh legal analysis.
So they can't just be lazy about it.
No, a compliance officer can't just say, oh, the UN delisted HTS, let's just unfreeze al-Sheikh's accounts. They have to meticulously check if he is still sanctioned under a separate parallel counterterrorism authority. It requires incredible daily diligence.
Wow. So what does this all mean? We've traced how these networks operate, right? From executives managing overseas portfolios to purchasers hiding munitions orders in this sea of small donations.
Yeah, massive web.
We've seen how governments try to squeeze them by breaking down jurisdictional walls and how the legal landscape is just constantly mutating. The big takeaway for me is that fighting terror isn't just about looking for a bad guy in a cave anymore.
Not at all.
It requires integrated data, skilled financial investigators, and treating the issue as a dynamic intelligence problem. The goal shouldn't just be to freeze funds after someone makes it onto a government list.
Right.
The goal is to identify the facilitators before they are listed, you know, to disrupt the architecture before that money turns into a mortar shell.
It requires a fundamental shift in mindset. Financial institutions have to move from reactive compliance, just checking boxes at the front door, to proactive network-based intelligence gathering.
Absolutely. And for you listening, I think it is profound to realize that the modern financial system, like the exact same infrastructure you use every day to buy a coffee, or use an app to split rent with your roommate, or buy a vintage jacket from an overseas merchant.
Yeah, that exact same system.
That frictionless convenience is the exact same infrastructure these networks exploit.
Yeah.
The banality of it is what makes it so dangerous.
It really is. And it leaves us with a critical dilemma as we look forward. As our financial systems become increasingly frictionless and decentralized, you know, with instant cross-border digital payments, unregulated digital wallets, less reliance on traditional banks,
right,
Are we inherently making it easier for illicit networks to hide their low-value transactions in the noise of global commerce?
That's a scary thought.
It is. How do we balance the demand we all have for absolute financial privacy and instant transaction speed with the absolute necessity of tracking the architects of conflict?
It's a tension that isn't going away anytime soon. It turns out, stopping a private army starts with reading the spreadsheets really, really well.